Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
You know, I ran for public advocate hoping that it could be an organizing platform and hoping that we could start to develop something of a new model. Very interesting job, and a job that I don't think when it was created in the 1989 charter was not necessarily thought through as well as it might have been. It is clearly a great job in terms of creating accountability in government, in terms of being a check and balance on whoever happens to be mayor, and this current mayor needs a lot of checking and balancing and has more power than I think anyone ever could have imagined a New York City mayor having. It's a great activist platform, it's a great bully pulpit, but what I thought it lacked was an organizing component and sort of taking full advantage of some of the pieces that existed in the job. Interestingly enough, sort of in the mishmash of roles that was created around public advocate, it sort of in some ways resembles what an attorney general does at the state level, but without as much legal authority. But there's a seat on the City Plan Commission, which is the ultimate decision-making power on all land use in the city. There's a seat on the Pension Board. It's a $35 billion pension board, which is a big player, not just locally, but nationally in the pension world. So I started to look at these pieces and said to myself, there's an opportunity to reconstruct this and create a more of an activist and an organizing approach here. And what we try to do in the first 6 months, obviously, we're trying to develop the model, but is to say, okay, we're now in a moment in history where the role of government is changing profoundly, and the economic dynamics of government are very unclear. And we have to take the tools we have and use them in a different way. To me, that means we have to take pension funds, we have to take the procurement that government does, we have to take all the tools at our disposal and start achieving more in the way of social goals with them. And that can range from very tangible things like making sure low-income city residents have opportunity or minority and women-owned businesses have opportunity, to achieving environmental goals. But there's also a dynamic that's happening in our nation in general that everyone's seeing about the political process, where I think pension funds and local governments and state governments can play a huge role, because basically what we see happening is the role of money in politics, the role of corporate American politics, is leaping forward. We had an immense victory as progressives in 2008 with the election of Obama, and he is, you know, I'll say very clearly, someone who I think is profoundly progressive on some levels and kind of, to me, not entirely satisfying on other levels as a progressive, but his victory was a tremendous step forward for the progressive movement. And some of the pieces, like healthcare reform and some elements of the financial reform, are tremendous steps forward. But at the same time, we have had corporate America and wealthy individuals playing more and more of a role in the political process, more and more effectively, sadly enough. And then the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case in January opened up a whole nother level. And I got very involved right after that decision because it became clear to me that states and cities and pension funds had to be part of the response, because that decision will warp our democracy forever if we let it do so. It's such a horribly, beautifully written decision that it leaves us very few courses of action. A lot of us hoped at the time that there would be congressional action to mitigate some of the elements of it. The Disclose Act is the piece that's now being discussed in Congress, but it's bogged down, and it's already July. And the question is, what's going to happen in this year of federal elections? This will be the template year. If corporate America takes advantage of Citizens United to the fullest extent this year, it will set a model that we'll be living with for years or decades to come. If it's stymied this year to the benefit of the democratic process, that might set a very helpful template. So I felt we all had to use every tool at our disposal. And what I've been trying to do with the pension fund that I sit on, the New York City Employees Retirement System, is push both across the board and individual corporation by individual corporation for full disclosure of all their political spending. Because it feels like to me, if we create a bit of a reverse arms race, if we create a dynamic where corporations are being challenged to be transparent, and those that are not transparent or those that are involved in heavy spending in federal elections that do not, and for on behalf of candidates who don't represent the values of consumers, that there is an opportunity there to take this very oblique dynamic of undisclosed corporate spending magnified by Citizens United and turn it the other way and make it a very public issue and take what looked like for some probably a great opportunity to affect the public, the election system to their advantage and make it a great negative for them. And just to put a point on this, the thinking goes like this. If you force a corporation to disclose, it's going to inhibit them from wanting to spend in the way they can through Citizens United, which essentially is a pretty damn unlimited way. So right there, you'll have an inhibiting dynamic. If some say they will not participate with the tools given to them by Citizens United, it puts pressure on others not to. If some do participate with the tools given them by Citizens United, but we have enough disclosure to track it and make it very public and create consumer boycotts even potentially with it, it might force a retrenchment and a reverse. Very tough stuff. I am not here to say this is going to be easy. In fact, I think it's going to be very challenging. But what I'm trying to say, and Katrina and I talked about some of this earlier, is that I think we have tools that we haven't taken advantage of as progressives, as people in government, that we're called upon to use now in a way that we just weren't in the past. You know, the legal structures around democracy got better over the last 100 years. Ironically, starting with Teddy Roosevelt, who started the whole concept of limiting corporate expenditures in politics. We've had an exact reverse this year, which means the federal dynamic, which was in some ways increasingly progressive over time, has now gone the other way. And what do? You respond at the grassroots, you respond at the state and local level, you respond with tools that weren't necessarily used in a political fashion but now need to be in an appropriate political fashion, like pension funds. Pension funds, public pension funds of this country, $3 trillion in investment, and ultimately managed by public officials, which means they are influenceable, which means there is a public debate that can be held, which can actually determine some of the course of their actions. Big asterisk, pension funds have an economic job to perform. They have to take care of retirees. They have to provide a result. No one's talking about politicizing them in contravention of their fiduciary responsibilities. I think the two can go together. But the point I guess I'm trying to make is, as a local official happening to be one of three citywide officials in the biggest city in the country, there's a set of tools we've barely even recognized as progressives that we need to employ now very aggressively. And I think it's particularly pertinent to this room, we need to nationalize this discussion, because any elected official around the country has to start feeling like it's their responsibility to, if they can't put the genie of Citizens United back in the bottle, to do something to limit the impact and to do it quickly. And I think that's just one, I'll finish by saying this, I think this is just one subset piece of these larger extraordinary economic changes we're going through, but I think there is a clear parallel between this discussion about the electoral process and a discussion of how do we navigate a world where government budgets are more constrained, but we still want to help people in need and we still want to create economic justice? I would argue that some of the same concepts apply, that we really haven't used our tools particularly creatively, that in the good times, a lot of stuff happened in government without a lot of discussion, without a lot of debate, in some form or fashion, because that's the way it was always done. We have much more transparency. We have, I think, the organizing capacity the new media gives us alone changes this discussion so much to the better if we use it right. And it seems to me that even though sometimes it's tempting to say, oh my God, we're entering an age of limits and an age of sort of the unknown, we're entering a dynamic where the economic instability feels like nothing we've quite seen before and governments are going to be limited in ways we can't quite imagine, I think my counter to that is we haven't used our tools, we haven't been particularly creative, we haven't insisted on government's economic power being employed, you know, with a sort of fuller sense of social conscience, and we haven't thought fully enough about the stimulative effect of government spending, not just on the federal level, but on the state and local level as well. And when I say that, I can back it up with the fact that New York City spends $63 billion a year on its expense budget, $10 billion on its capital budget, $105 billion when you combine all of its pension funds together. So there's something real to work with. And I think in a sense we have to demand that. We have to demand a recalibration of our approach. And the only way that happens is from the grassroots. And so to me, my job as a public official is to sort of help move the debate. And to move the debate, it's not just a traditional press conference or putting out the policy report. It's also organizing people and using new media and believing that the more public discussion occurs, the more things swing our way. And I certainly think going to finish one last finish on back on the Citizens United point. From the second that decision came down, I happened to be on Brian Lehrer's show on WNYC talking about something entirely different. It was homelessness policy or something. And he literally broke in and said, this decision happened. Everyone knew it might be coming, but I think everyone wanted to believe it couldn't quite be as horrible as this. And he summarized just how horrible it was. And what immediately went through my brain is, in a funny way, and I was very sad that it was as bad as it was, but in a funny way, the sheer excessiveness of it opened a door for organizing and for raising public consciousness and turning the tables. And I think we always have had more tools at our disposal than we give ourselves credit for. And so to me, that's my obligation as an elected official to start using those tools. And I think it's a natural place for us to work together.
So what is the basis of your belief or faith that the public actually will care, right, about excessive spending by corporations? I mean, there already are enormous PACs in D.C., industry lobbies that have had a tremendous impact on the shape of the healthcare debate. You have the Democratic Party, who, as much as they object to the Citizens United decision, will also be now buying to stay on the good side of many of these corporations. So where, in addition to the tools, where is that anger going to come from? I mean, I don't see it,
I don't blame you for not seeing it. And obviously the Democratic Party in its current iteration is a kind of complicated dynamic on this issue. And the Obama election is the best example in the world of that. I mean, when we suddenly became the party that had more money than the other party, when did that happen? That was an interesting dynamic. And the Obama phenomenon was one part the grassroots money, which really does change the equation and can continue to, but it was also one part that a lot of the capitalist class closed ranks behind him. And you're right. So some people will be enlightened enough to say, let's fight this thing. And some people say, how do we take advantage of it? So I don't for a minute miss that. And I agree with you if you say there's a lot of money in politics right now and there's not a lot, I'd cry. True. I would also say, though, we as progressive people have not painted the picture particularly well. And maybe a crisis is what paints that picture, which is often the case in history. Now, if you said to me, would you like a world where corporate America stands back from Citizens United entirely and the world doesn't change and we go on? Of course I would rather have that world. Because the notion that a single company could put $1 million into a U.S. Senate race or a congressional race and could obviously change the outcome, that's plenty scary to me. So I'd rather nothing changed on that level. I find it hard to believe that we're going to get through the year 2010 without someone pulling the trigger. When they pull the trigger, I think the whole discussion changes if we all force it to change. And I take the 2004 and the 2008 dynamics to say that the Dean experience, the Obama experience, we took things that were fundamentally impossible and they were achieved before our very eyes, and now we all think it's normal. The fundraising, that was impossible. There was no model for anything like that. The meetups and all that, there was no model for anything like that. Oh, by the way, a black guy got elected president, It's like there are so many things that sort of horrible things and incredibly positive things happening simultaneously, and we're almost a bit numb that we aren't seeing the sweep of these things. So I would say, try and get to the core of your question, Exxon puts $1 million into, someone choose, it's Connecticut, to help Linda McMahon, although she's a bad example. She has her $1 million. Some places they don't have it. There may be that one touchstone with a pernicious enough player that wakes people up to the fact that it really is corporate America trying to assert itself in a different fashion. And I don't think I'm missing something here. I think in the end, this country doesn't love politicians and doesn't necessarily love government that much, but even more so doesn't love the corporate world.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.